This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers, and world events unfold in real time. Now you could trade them with IBKR prediction markets, trade election, climate, and economic outcomes alongside stocks, options, and bonds, all on one integrated platform. There are simple yes or no contracts priced to reflect the market's view of probability. If your prediction is right, you receive $1 per contract and earn interest on your position while you're invested. IBKR prediction markets turn market expectations into actionable trades. Prediction contracts are not suitable for all investors. Learn more at IBKR.com/predictions.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Inflation is as sticky as old pine sap. Another round of China meetings happening. We're not really figuring too much will happen there. Universal basic income. That's something. Hints and whispers about that is all over the place. And a warm welcome back for this week's guest, Ed Easterling from Crestmont Research. All this and much more on episode number 973 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome back to all of you that have been here before. And of course, if you're new, well, thanks for joining us this time. And hopefully you'll stick around for some time into the future to hear all the good things that we have all about education and finance and getting to that point of financial security and financial independence. And most importantly, staying and being disciplined in an investment environment that is, dare I say, choppy. Interesting, sometimes hard to handle. So today what I thought we'd do, would we spend some time digging into staying with the area of the markets for the most part, because at the top of the show, I think it's important to really discuss what's going on sometimes. You know, last episode, we talked about things related to things that weren't necessarily basic investing principles necessarily. We talked about, you know, these ideas of AI and what's going to happen there and how potentially AI is going to be or maybe isn't going to be a taker of jobs, you know, the next employer and taking us, you, me, and all of us out of our positions. And I think that the big issue right now is that we have to look past that like markets are doing, because right now there is, I dare say, a relentless mix of optimism and innovation that's going on right now. And I would say unusual economic headwinds that are really pushing and pulling things really dramatically. So when we talk about some of the things that are going on right now, here we are, mid-May 2026. And the stock market is pretty much showing remarkable resilience. The S&P 500 is up solidly year to date. The NASDAQ is great. We're over 7,400, give or take a couple of points, either direction on a daily basis, but right at that level that nobody thought we were going to get to for some time. Analysts forecasting continued gains, right? Looking at targets like 7,600, 8,100 by the end of the year. I mean, at this pace, there's the potential for us to getting there much quicker. And that's really kind of amazing if you think about what's going on. The idea that here we are in a year where there's so many headwinds and so many things that are going against us. But in fact, what we're seeing is that the markets continue going higher. Why? Why? People want to know what's going on. Why is it that we're seeing this continuation of the substantial amount of gains that are going on with all the negative things that could be construed as problematic for the markets? All these things that are going on right now, Are they a problem? Yeah, they are a problem. And we have inflation, we have wars, we have never-ending geopolitical tensions around the world, continuation of a basically neutered Congress, and this is not going to stop anytime soon. But what is it? People want to know, like, why? Why are earnings continuing to do better? Why are stocks? Well, it is all about that. It's all about the incredible ability for companies that are the best in class to do what they can to shut out the outside issues. And if they are issues that are going to be problematic, they will figure ways around. They'll figure ways to actually make things happen. And earnings are what is driving markets right now. Corporate America is delivering. There's no question about that. And we saw that last quarter with a high amount of companies, you know, 80%+ of companies beating S&P 500, in the S&P 500 beating earnings estimates, huge percentage of beating revenue as well. And we're seeing this robust growth and this continuation of the AI tech resurgence, the new capital spending, the infrastructure demands, the growth and the requirements that are going into this, from chips to cloud services to everything in between. And what's really, I think, pushing investors is that forward estimates continue to rise. We've seen that now we're double-digit earnings growth that are looking at the next year ahead, and think, you know, somewhere 10 to 15% or more in some cases, actually. And that is actually helping in a dramatic way push the valuations of stocks to levels where we haven't seen them in a long time. And I'm sure that when we talk to Ed today, he's going to talk about the CAPE ratio. He's going to talk about the Crestmont earnings ratio and his number, the summation. Companies are posting record profits in many cases. And at the same time, they're providing record spending. That record spending is creating even greater profits and the potential for even further, I would say, levered profits in the future. It's a classic earnings-driven rally that is going on right now, and that is something to really take notice of. And this is extending the bull rally that many thought might stall out. We thought there was going to be a problem entering this war, and to our surprise, gladly so, the fact is that things are doing pretty well. Now, there's going to be a cliff coming. I guarantee you that. There is going to be a moment in time that will happen in the future that is going to cause a big problem when it comes to this particular issue of, can earnings continue at this breakneck pace for an elongated period of time in the future? And at the same time, is that going to allow for investors to keep looking past, or not even looking, blindfoldedly just buying into the markets right now? It's not all sunshine right now. There's no question that inflationary pressures are causing problems. They're back in the conversation big time after what we saw last week. The latest CPI showed that we're at 3.8% on a year-over-year basis, 2.8% if we strip out food and energy, which is hard to do, but we can. And I think this is a really good reminder that the post-pandemic inflation hunt, this whole issue that we've been trying to really get under wraps for the last number of years, is still not dead. I start out by saying that it's sticky like pine tar. You ever dealt with pine tar? You know what I'm talking about. We just can't get rid of this. And now we're at three-year highs for some of these numbers. So you look at all this and you put it all into a giant bowl. You shake it up, you mix it up, and you look at it and you're like, wow, what a mess. But in fact, despite all that sentiment, not consumer sentiment, but investor sentiment, stays bullish. Why? Earnings momentum. Gets back to the same situation. Earnings momentum is driving the markets right now. And this is kind of an AI super cycle that we're seeing right now, that providing this powerful offset to all the problems that we're seeing. And investors are willing to do whatever they got to do to get in on it as fast as possible. Forget the fact that, you know, ratios are high. Forget the fact that we're seeing that the PEG ratio, PE ratios, we're seeing that, you know, the market itself and individual companies are off the charts in terms of historic numbers. It's this environment where we see, you know, bad news is good news, good news is good news, And everybody wants to believe that all this is going to end and be, you know, great on the other side. And it may be. And that brings me to something that's fascinating that happened just this week. And I think we need to talk about this. One of the things that is happening, we saw that South Korea has been on fire. I think it's up 175% on a year-over-year basis, up 78% last year, up 80% already this year. They have only a few companies, SK Hynix, Samsung, and a few others that are really fueling this entire rally. But nonetheless, it's a rally that is bringing incredible amount, trillions of dollars of increased market cap. I think it's up to $3.1 trillion, their total market cap of their market, getting towards where Germany is. And that's a far cry from where they were just 2 years ago. This is a small country. They only have a finite number of things that they can really produce. And in fact, one of the problems they're having and why they were the hardest hit when the war happened was that they rely basically on all 100% of their oil from outside of their own country, thereby utilizing primarily the Straits of Hormuz for delivery. And that's causing a major energy crunch there. But again, it doesn't seem to matter when everybody's just looking to buy the chips companies. And that's why it is powering what's going on there. Now, last week, what we saw was very interesting. There was some conversation going on. There was a this very interesting idea that's been floating around for a long time called universal basic income. Essentially, the deal is that if AI is going to take everybody's jobs, what are we going to all do for money? Well, the concept is that we'll have this income stream that is paid for by the AI generation, by the generation of maybe the power and the power grid, or maybe the efficiencies that it creates through taxes, et cetera, the government will provide. Well, just this week, they came out with something. The presidential advisor, Kim Jong-boom, he came out with this concept of a national dividend, or I think they even called it something like a citizen's dividend. And that citizen's dividend is essentially a redistribution of the earnings of many of these companies from the AI and semiconductor space, and they're putting that into the public hands, back to the public. So it's kind of a tax that goes back to the individuals. Now, South Korea is clearly ground zero for the surge in chip demand powering AI, and companies, again, like SK Hynix and Samsung, they're printing money. I mean, just printing the money. Let's go. Just giving it out to them. And they're just making bank. No question about that. But the country built this industrial base over decades. And they're now saying, you know, we have been building this infrastructure for such a long time for you to create the kind of profits you need to pay us back now. And the citizens of our country that pay the taxes into this and that we helped you do this with are going to get the benefit. UBI. They're not calling it necessarily UBI. They're calling it a citizen's dividend. But the question I ask is, how much of this is going to start spreading, the idea spreading, that we have this very strange populist movement throughout the world that is both liberal and conservative, that is hard left and hard right, that is probably going to provide for a lot of conversation about how something like this should really play into the elections. And I would venture to say that there's going to be some talk about all these big money baggers making money, the Microsofts and the Metas and NVIDIAs of the world and AMD and even Intel that the government is now owns a piece of, how these companies should be actually thanking all of us and paying us back as individuals with a citizen's dividend. There's going to be talk about this. There's going to be talk about windfall profits, how this is a bad thing, and how companies aren't paying their fair share, and how, again, we should redistribute this wealth. This boom to fund things like youth startups, rural basic income plus, support for artists, stronger pensions, and even social investments, and even fortifying the municipalities around the country. That is something I think that's going to be extremely out there. Now, do I agree with it? That's another discussion entirely. This is not something I think is part of capitalism in any way, shape, or form, but it's going to get some play with the amount of money that's being generated right now. is going to be something. Now, from a capitalism standpoint, what happened? Well, when this was announced, Korea was down 5%. Now, mind you, it's been up 3%, 4%, 5% day after day after day for the last month. So a 5% hit, which is pretty substantial, may seem like a lot, but it's really not that big of a deal. Considering this idea, this bold idea that calling it the echoes, this, you know, UBI, this universal basic income concept, markets are not going to be happy with it. They're going to find this as a money grab of epic proportions that are being done to the companies that are the backbone of corporate America. And what's going to happen if that happens, I will tell you. Companies start laying off more people, causing more problems. It's a problem. So we're going to have to watch this very carefully. And as we head into 2026 and we get deeper and deeper into this year, the markets are telling us, hey, we like the earnings story really a lot. I have a feeling that this UBI discussion is going to be out there through the midterms probably, and other countries may even pick it up. But with inflation rearing its head as it is, and with the confluence of the potential for a slowdown in earnings, eventually it's probably going to end up being a dead end. So this South Korea issue makes us think a little bit bigger. It makes us want to ask questions. I get it. And a lot of people who have not participated in the market upsize want to think and want to know, hey, where's my potential in all this, right? Where am I going to make all the money from this? I see everybody else making money. Well, you know what? You should have invested in the markets. You should have invested in the AI companies. You should have invested in this, in the solar, semiconductor companies and everything else out there. So we're going to talk more about this with our guest today, but I wanted to kind of give you some of the things that are going on that are pretty fascinating in the world of investing. Let's take a minute to talk about Interactive Brokers, because, you know, you research your investments, right? You analyze markets, but have you researched your broker? For the past 3 years, Interactive Brokers' individual clients average a 24.3% annual return, beating the S&P 500. Lower costs, competitive rates, and access to over 170 global markets helped investors keep more of what they earn. The broker you choose matters. Interactive Brokers, member SIPC. Learn more at ibkr.com/performance. That's ibkr.com/performance. Let me talk about our guest for a second here and tell you who he is. His name is Ed Easterling. He's the founder and president of Crestmont Holdings. Based in Oregon, it's an investment management research firm that publishes provocative research on the financial markets at CrestmontResearch.com. He has over 30 years of alternative investment experience, including financial markets, private equity, and business operations. So Ed Easterling, man, it's been a while. What's going on over in Crestmont?
Well, things going well here. I think we're watching all the different factors we have kind of driving this market to new highs, and just wondering where the trend is headed and what the risks are underneath it.
You know what? Let's you and I go back down memory lane for a second, and let's talk about a month or two ago. With all the things that you now know to be true, but looking back, which we didn't know, is there some kind of space in between reality of what we know and what it seems we should have known? In other words, let me say that a different way. War, inflation, higher oil, tariffs being turned back, blah, 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 blah. All of that stuff, that uncertainty, did not call for at that time markets to new highs. But yet here we are. So a little splaining needs to be done.
I think that's a good place to start.
So tell me, what is it? Is it just the incredible bleed of CapEx from the tech, the extraordinary amount of stimulus that's being brought to everybody right now from the excess amount from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and the withholding allowance that's been given back for tax returns? And on top of that, the fact of the matter is that tariffs are now being repaid back to companies. Is that the three things? It's got to be more than that, doesn't it? I mean, it's kind of crazy.
Well, and then investor psychology. and just a sense that we've got this bull trend that has a lot of momentum behind it. You know, maybe kind of getting into this, just put it in perspective. Remember, I'm watching this as a market climatologist. So I think in terms of multiple years or decade, as opposed to the short run. At the same time, trying to weigh these things that you just mentioned, that are things that all kind of juice the market in the short term. They often come with trade-offs. And I think the effect of that is sometimes when you kind of juice it up front, you do have a period that sort of compensates for that on the back end. But when I think about it on a long-term basis, many of the things that you just mentioned, and those are things that are affecting the market and the market's perception, are not things that are going to endure for another decade or longer.
Yeah, these are short-term phenomena, and trying to gauge the long-term from the short-term is like trying to say that it's cold outside, we're entering a new ice age.
Right, which, by the way, doesn't mean that we shouldn't take advantage of this short-term move. It's just we need to recognize that at some point, it's not going to be long-term sustainable.
Does it seem to you that almost every downstroke of the market is like a bat signal to investors to start getting their money ready and throwing it hard into the markets? It seems like there's more investor sentiment that turns positive right off the bottom in a big way than anything that I've ever seen in a long time. This has happened, by the way, consecutive times over the last decade, let's call it, than the last 30 years that I've been looking at markets or the last 200 years that I've been studying markets.
Absolutely. I think that, again, that's part of the resilience that's in the market. That as we see things bounce back so quickly, we look out at forecasts for earnings growth, double digits and more. Despite the fact that we get these rising inflation reports, I think there's kind of a tendency to want to see that as temporary. And so we look past it. I think that's what leads investors to take advantage of every bargain opportunity.
So you've, I think, long argued that, and as you're telling me, that markets, they move in these long cycles. So when we look at these cycles and you study these cycles as a market climatologist, as a market watcher, two questions. Where do you think we are in that cycle today, potentially? Now, you want to use a baseball term, you want to use some other percentage, fine. And with that, what do you think maybe is the biggest mistake investors are making as a result?
I would say right now, a lot of the factors. Now, and by the way, when we talk about this market's roaring ahead, we're getting these above average returns. It doesn't necessarily mean that the offset to that are negative returns or crashes.
Okay.
What it does mean historically is that we had above average periods and below average periods, and the average rarely happens.
Okay.
So one of the consequences here could be just an extended period of below average, which would still be disappointing, especially if people are budgeting based upon this level of return. Now, you said, where are we? Let's see, sports analogies. And by the way, I'm not the right guy to bring up sports analogies with.
Yep.
But I would say we're long in the game. When you look at all the factors of where the economy is, you look at the profit margins, you look at asset valuations, both homes and stock market and other assets. Things are late cycle.
So, I mean, let's use a clock. Are we at 6 p.m.? Are we at 3 p.m.? Are we at 9 p.m.?
Well, clocks have a fixed dial. And I think in the market, I think maybe this is a discussion about Icarus more so than it is the clock. Mm. Icarus has moved past that point of no return, but he can go a lot further before the sun will melt off those wings. And so this market could have a lot more beneath it to keep it going.
And is that your...
But the alternative is it could not. So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I understand that there is a lot of investor sentiment that's positive, which, by the way, blows in the face of consumer sentiment, which is fascinating. And it blows in the face of what we're seeing from the long haul higher potential cost of fuel, CPI, which we'll get into a second, inflation. But I think, you know, what you're saying to me is that I think the undertone of what you're saying is what is likely the right thing is, you know what, there's no reason to panic just yet.
I think that's, oh, absolutely. There's no reason to panic. And matter of fact, and good investors never panic because they're prudent going in.
Right.
And they're always established in a way that they can be resilient against pullbacks. And you can't always avoid losing money, but you can certainly be more resilient to the risk.
But valuations, right? Valuations is something you talk about a lot. It's something that you really focus in on. That's part of your process, right?
So, absolutely. And I typically focus on the price earnings ratio and dividend yield and other measures of valuation. But as you've seen, you can pull a list of the top 10 valuation measures, whether it's Tobin's Q, whether it's market value to sales, market value to assets, all of that out there, all those measures are elevated.
Every single one.
Absolutely. Now, the question is it justified? And there are two key factors that drive that valuation level. One is the growth rate of earnings, and the second is the inflation rate.
And both are moving higher.
The inflation rate is elevated. It's every attempt we get to get it back to that price stability level below 2% hasn't been successful. So I think jury's out on that one, at least in the near term, certainly for the next year or so. In terms of growth rate of earnings, they have posted growth rates that are far in excess of the economic growth. What that translates into is profit margins, and profit margins are near record levels right now. And from a business cycle standpoint, that tends to suggest late in cycle, not early in cycle.
Why is that?
As companies, business is good, companies are expanding, sales are positive, profit margins increase. When at some point margins get large enough that it brings in new competitors, when new competitors come in or less efficient competitors, the competitive factor drives those margins back down. And that wipes out the marginal player, and then the business cycle starts over again.
So this is what's interesting is there's a tale of many stories here where we see an incredible amount of CapEx being spent, whether it's circular financing, venue financing, or direct financing. I don't care how it is, but the bottom line is we have huge, enormous. We're not talking about 100 million. We're talking about multiple hundreds of billions of dollars being spent on stuff. There's leakage, by the way, in that, and that ends up somehow in the markets, but it also ends up in the hands of players that will be increasing their prices, which will then be forcing the other players that are spending the money to increase their spend because they need this. They are not walking away from like, oh, you know what? I don't know if we need that chip. Nope. They're buying it anyway, regardless of the price, no matter how tough it is to get. They're going to go and they're going to oversubscribe to it because they don't want it going up. They're buying more than they need to make sure they have the compute. We got that. Fine. That's one story. And that is impacting the biggest of the big companies in a lot of different ways. But because it is that, and we have a market cap weighted indices out there, that's a good thing. Okay, fine. We hear last week from a company like, I think it was last week or the week before, Whirlpool. They come out and they talk about some horrible numbers, by the way, and their outlook is terrible. And they are saying that the war in Iran is creating a depression, recessionary mindset that they haven't seen in a very long time by their customers. People are just not buying. Now, it's just not buying their goods, not buying their washing machines and their dryers. And I would, because I think they stink, by the way. I just got rid of all my Whirlpools. That's a different discussion. But nonetheless, maybe something's there. And then finally, we see another example on the other side of a company like Shake Shack. Shake Shack came out with earnings a couple of weeks back. A week and a half back, I think it was. And what was interesting about that was, if you really just take a moment, just a second, and think about it, and you think about, Shake Shack, what's happening? Shake Shack is, they were down huge on their number. The lowest they've been, I think the high of Shake Shack back about a year ago was, 130? Currently trading at 68. They're in the market with burgers. That's what Shake Shack does, right? Plus other things. But in the market of burgers, and they put tomatoes on it, all those prices are skyrocketing. Beef prices out of control, not to mention GLP-1s that are stopping people from eating a lot of this stuff. So they are in that too. So we got a weird market environment that doesn't seem to want to go down very much for anything, but yet underneath it, there's a rotation and weird things happening.
I think part of it is there's a complacency that's been driven by the fact that economically, we haven't been bitten with a recession, with a real recession, in such a long time. Matter of fact, put it in perspective, the last recession technically was the 2 month recession at the start of COVID. And I don't think anybody thinks that was a cathartic, a kind of a typical, you know, reset recession.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So what that does is it takes us back to the start of that period, which would have been essentially at the 2009, at the end of the 2007-2009 recession. So to put this in perspective, and I think a lot of people consider the what happened in the technical 2 month recession during 2020 to be, let's say, a footnote, kind of COVID caused. If we look at the current expansion as having started in 2009 and run to present, matter of fact, we're now over 200 months.
200
without a recession. Put that in perspective.
Without a declared recession.
Without a cathartic recession. Again, I'd like to. There was a declared recession at the COVID. NBER did declare that 2 months,
right?
February of 2020 to April, 2 months, February to March, March to April, as a recession period. But I would consider that from an economic standpoint, that the economy that was not a cathartic. It wasn't a reset. Matter of fact, if anything, ironically, that recession probably caused more dislocation than it corrected.
Yeah.
Because, you know, recessions happen because prices get out of line, profits get out of line, spending gets out of line, capital gets out of line, things get out of line. Labor gets too tight. And that's what drives recessions. So the last time we had one of those was the 2007-2009 period. The longest recession in history, excluding the current period, was 120 months. And then before that, 106 months. I mean, so we're nearly twice as long as the historically long recession. I'm sorry, expansion.
Expansion. Yeah, I was thinking, when was that? I don't remember.
No.
I don't remember recession long, for 10 years. Okay.
No, expansion, exactly. Okay. Expansion.
So expansion, so, longest expansion in history prior to the current 10 years, round number.
Yes. And I think the message there is that time does not drive a recession. Dislocations drive recessions. So I'm not suggesting that because we're long in the tooth on time, that we're due for a recession. What I'm saying is that it has been a long time. And if we look at the dislocations that are out there, some of the things you just mentioned, the magnitude of what some would consider irrational spending on creating data centers and power plants, et cetera, just to power AI. If AI doesn't turn into an AI like .com, could change life as we know it. But if it doesn't create profitability and perpetual profitability, it won't justify all the expense that went into it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about just the other day about this whole idea of the chip cycle. And again, a couple of weeks ago, AMD came out with their numbers and they came out with a stellar report, just absolutely beautiful. And one of the things they talked about was, and why the stock went up so much, was that over the next 3 or 4 years, they're predicting about a 35% increase in revenue year over year for the next X amount of years. And what's interesting about that was, and why people got so excited and offsided about it, was just in November, they were predicting about 17% of an increase. Now, if you stop for a second and think about that, they were thinking 17% increase year over year for a number of years. And just 6 months later, December, January, February, March. 5 months later, they're talking about how there's going to be a doubling of that number over the next 4 years on an annual basis. These are big numbers we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it very fascinating that people seem to forget the entire semiconductor cycle over history, which has been boom to bust, boom to bust, boom to bust, right? And you've studied it. You know it, right? Semiconductors are definitely one of the most cyclical items out there.
Right.
What makes us so sure that in 6 months from now, they're not going to have a major tweak to their numbers just as easily as they had a major tweak to their numbers? Because I think psychology is, well, you increase from 70 to 35, they may go from 35 to 50. But what happens if there's another technology, lack of money? The list goes on and on. Have you thought about that? That's a pretty interesting concept, right?
Well, other factors that we have sort of extrapolated out, whether it's that earnings, the S&P 500 earnings growth, projected to be more than 20% year over year. I mean, what happens when that gets revised back to something more realistic at some point? And again, it doesn't mean we won't have a year or two or three of that, but what we won't have is 10 years of it. What we're very unlikely to have is 10 years.
Well,
unless this time's different.
That goes into a discussion of CAPE that I know you're very fond of talking about. I'd like you to do me a favor. I'd like you to spend a moment talking about, because this is something that you is really in your bag of tricks, I think. The CAPE ratio, what it is, how you look at it. There's different ones to look at. CAPE 20, CAPE 10s and all that, right? It's different ones, but different periods. But basically, this is the Shiller-created device to figure out valuations that are really appropriate.
Yes. And a big element of this is that the earnings go through a business cycle, and that business cycle can be 5 to 10 years. And so CAPE is conservative, and it uses 10-year period. And so it looks at the earnings that happened over the last 10 years, the ups and downs, put them all together, inflation adjust them, and use that as your earnings base against the current valuation level. Because what Shiller found was that at times when we have a soaring profit margin, that tends to understate PE. And then when you get the pullbacks in earnings, that tends to overstate because you've lowered the denominator in relation to valuation. So the way to normalize that, or the way that he normalizes that, is by taking 10 years worth of earnings, inflation adjustment present, and then use that as a denominator. And it's been a pretty good, it's not a trading signal in any way.
And because it's so long until something moves, right?
Right. So therefore, it does tend to reflect the normalized longer term trend of relative valuation. And so that's where the KPE is useful, is to put valuation in relative perspective. Crestmont has a different version. The Crestmont PE is based on looking at the relationship between the long-term relationship between earnings and GDP, the economy. Mm-hmm. And historically, those, again, there's a business cycle that runs at a much more a rapid pace than the economic cycle. But by looking at the normalized relationship between the two of those, it, like the CAPE, if anything, the two of them come at a normalized PE very differently. But what they do provide is they have a very high correlation between them, because normalizing earnings gets out so much noise that can be distorting. The reason all this is important is that what Shiller has shown, what Crestmont has shown, is that the normalized PE is a pretty good predictor of longer term returns.
Forward returns. Right.
And because if you buy things at an expensive rate today, what you can count on is you will have a lower dividend yield, that those cash dividends relative to a higher price will have a lower yield, right? That's just math. The second thing you can count on is that when you start with high valuations, your dividend yield is lower, your likelihood of expansion of PE becomes lower at higher levels, and therefore your 5 and 10 and 20 year returns will typically be below average. And that's what history has shown. So what Shiller believes about the CAPE, and what I believe about the Crestmont PE and the CAPE, are that they're good indicators of what we can expect for the next decade, not necessarily what we can expect for the next few years or even 5 years.
Now, you put your name on this, so you must have a lot of strong belief and feeling that this is something that you could be proud of and something that you could actually rely on and something that when you talk about is not going to let you down. So what is it telling you exactly right now?
It's telling us that we're set for a decade from this point of below average returns.
Now, couldn't we say that 2 years ago?
Oh, absolutely.
And then if that's the case, just follow me here for a second. If 2 years ago, we believed we were going to have below average returns over the next decade, okay? Now we subtract 2 years, we're 8 years into that part of the decade, right? And we've had above average returns over the last 2 years. Does that mean we get below average returns?
The answer is yes, because valuations are now higher than they were a few years ago. By the way, likewise, we could have, not just 2 years ago, you could have 5 or 6 years ago, when valuations had moved up to levels that were above historical, were in relatively high levels, one would have said then that they would have been below average. I think the biggest difference is, and you can look at some of Grantham's, you know, estimates and forecasts and others for returns, they have gotten markedly more negative because at at higher valuations, at some point, well, something has to change at some point, or there's a reckoning of valuation back to more rational levels. But it doesn't mean it takes a crash to do that. What it can mean is just a kind of a choppy, muddle along period of below average returns that the aggregate, matter of fact, let's put in perspective. When the market pulled back, even in coming off of 2000, we had a decade of the 2000s that was well below average returns.
Right.
Only when we got out into the 2010s and then we started to move valuations back up, did we start to see returns pick up. And the reason we've seen such significant multi-10-year returns over the last few years, the ends of 10-year periods being so high, is we now have a CAPE at 31. We now have even reported PE without doing a normalized is over 25. And historically, those numbers would be around 15 or 16.
Today, the it's interesting because there are a lot of beliefs and there's a lot of people that are creating predictions. You know, yes. We have the Tom Lees of the world or the, you know, that come on and say, you know, we're going to have a, whatever the number, 7,800 of the S&P by the end of the year. And he's been right. And I don't know, by the way, if the markets actually would have been down if he still would have these beliefs, right? This seems to be a constant bullishness and television and financial shows have they like it. And as a matter of fact, you know, you see a Jeremy Siegel come on the show when things are down and out, they bring on Jeremy Siegel because he's usually, although lately he's been a little bit less, you know, exciting in terms of being bullishness. But there's all these people doing predictions on there. But I think you often emphasize the discipline side, which is good. And that's why you're on the Discipline Investor Podcast, by the way. But what does discipline practically look like for investors in the next few years and what you would look to do as well as an investor?
I think what it says is that we want to have an exposed, but a relatively hedged of sorts, position in the markets, both whether it's bonds, stocks, et cetera. We need to recognize that that there are ways to structure portfolios. And again, I'm a market climatologist. I'm not, and as people found in Unexpected Returns, the book I wrote over a decade ago, almost 15 years ago, almost 20 years ago.
Time flies. Stop right there. It can be 30 by the time you're done. Go ahead.
It does. So the message, I think it's that, again, we leave it to the experts to pick the way to structure portfolios, but the goal is to be able to participate in the upside at a greater rate than you participate in the downside. To recognize that there are ways to structure portfolios, ways to diversify portfolios, diversify for risk, so that if we do have those pullbacks, we do have those storms, that we still get a reasonable level of return and that we, again, remember the first rule of investing is don't lose money. Yeah. In realistically, for many investors, it means lose less money because losing less money in a big downturn has a significant effect because the losses are disproportionate to gains. If you lose 10%, you got to make 11% to make it up. But if you lose
50, that's the one I always give people. I always say, 100%. It's a quiz. This is my baseline financial quiz for investors who just want to like let it all loose. You know what I mean? I say, if you lose 50%, how much do you have to make back to get to square one? You know what their answer is. You know what their answer is.
It's 100. Right? It's 100%.
But you know what their answer usually is, right?
50, right? Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just like the NASDAQ investor that lost 80%. Okay. It takes 400% to make that back. I mean, it's just, it gets the loss is disproportionate to gain. So it may not sound like a big difference, but if you can control, if they're in a 20 or 30% drawdown market, if you can contain your losses to 10%, you're well positioned with 11% to get back to even. But the other portfolios that were just passively exposed have a long way to go.
Yep.
But again, I shouldn't be saying things like that to the disciplined investor, because obviously that's a big part of what discipline's about.
Well, the funny thing is, Bo, this leads me to my next thought that I was thinking about as I'm talking to you here, is when we talk about these disciplines, we talk about all the things that are going on. We talk about the news, we talk about the flim flam trading and all that, and these crazy commercials that you see. By the way, I'm off of most regular news. You know, the regular news, big news station, off of that. CNBC is in the morning is just killing me. I can't deal with it anymore. There's some guests here and there, or background or news and all. Bloomberg television, by the way, to me, is the place. If I want to know about investing issues and economy and global issues, non-politics, Bloomberg's the place. It's just easy. And most people have this. And I don't know why people aren't, if that's what you want to do. The other stuff is all for entertainment, it seems to me. But my point is, when we talk about these disciplines, we talk about, you know, what people do with predictions and what this means for people. If we look at all the things that investors are looking at and that's what's widely accepted as the belief that's inherently ingrained with most investors today, what do you think that history will prove wrong?
I think history will prove right that there was over-optimism at this period, and that and it will prove that discipline is important for investing, that diversified approach is very important to investing, and I think some of that's being lost in this environment.
You're talking about, you know, irrational exuberance to a degree.
Well, and I'm just thinking about some of the signs that are out there. One thing that I came across my desk a week ago or so is the change that Standard & Poor's is proposing for IPOs. They're talking about, because of some of these, you mentioned AI and all the spending, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we know the AI companies are losing a lot of money, but they have these huge valuations. And so they're looking to go public. Well, they're going to waive the rule that requires that IPOs be profitable to get into the index. And they're going to accelerate the period of time from 12 months to 6 months that they have to wait.
Well, this is what the NASDAQ is doing. The NASDAQ is appeasing SpaceX when they come out within, I want to say it's 5 days or something crazy, that they'll be included in the NASDAQ 100.
And to me, that is, and you think about as well, the how concentrated the index gains have been in a short list of stocks. So we're reducing transparency. We have this ultra high concentration of effect that I think it's translated. I think most people, rather than looking at buying a basket of 500 stocks, what they're really getting is kind of half a basket of, or more than half a basket of 7 stocks and a basket of 493 stocks. But there's a perception of diversification that doesn't exist. Because it's so concentrated in its gains.
And I had a guest on a couple of weeks ago that talked about this. We talked about, 'cause I talk about this a lot. I talk about this because it's still to this day hard for me to wrap my head around the market cap weighted index concept with all these big companies being the largest of them, right?
Yes.
And with people, like you said, thinking it's diversified, but he said something to me that was really, I was like, you know, that makes a lot of sense, because we're talking about momentum investing and we're talking about trend following. And trend following always was like this idea that I read about Michael Cavall's book, you know, the Turtle Traders and all that. I read about this and a few others out there, and I was like, I don't get it. I don't get it. And he said something to me, I think it was it Meb? I don't know, somebody, I forgot, it was the last couple of weeks. I'm not sure who it was exactly. But anyway, the idea was this, that if you want to do the ultimate trend following, or maybe it was Howard Lindzen, if you want to do the ultimate trend following, just follow an S&P 500 market cap weighted, because what's happening is the larger companies are getting larger and you're following that trend as they get larger. And technically the S&P 500, the NASDAQ 100, is the ultimate trend following tool, if you think about it, for the lazy trend follower.
Because of the current market dynamic.
Yeah, because the current market dynamic and the way that of the construction of the constituents inside of that particular index. I don't know why S&P, do you know why, do you have any inkling why S&P is going to do this?
Oh, I think that it's trying to include some of these major companies in the index.
So you're talking about the Anthropics, the SpaceX, yes. and OpenAI potentially?
Exactly, yep.
And they're going to disband their rule. I wonder how that is going to impact, I guess, index traders it doesn't matter to, but how that's going to impact S&P benchmarking funds. That seems like a pretty drastic move on their part.
Well, and the third component that they're going to waive also is normally they have that they require that there be more than at least 10% of the stock of the company be publicly traded. And they're going to waive that requirement too. I mean, I think it's the kind of measures that if we talked about the things that S&P would be known for being more of a stalwart of a prudent index, right? Not a more aggressive space like we find the NASDAQ to be. But S&P, I think they're trying to be competitive. They're trying to be relevant, and they're trying to include the types of companies that that I think are driving market valuations today.
That could bite them in the ass pretty good, though.
I think absolutely.
And if I was to place my bet on that, I would say it would bite their ass more than longer term. If in fact the waiving the rights, see what's going to happen is that investors are going to get pretty pissed off that in the NASDAQ 100, SpaceX is going to be allowed to enter into it, especially with the current structure. If you read anything recently about the structure of how the share class are and the lack of friendliness to shareholders in this deal compared to what Elon Musk owns. What's interesting about this is if they're allowed in five days or whatever it is, some short period of time before the lockup periods expire, the rug pull is going to be on the public markets that is going to be pulled by the insiders on this deal because you have a fully valued deal, $1.5 trillion plus or minus a few trillion of this. It's a total rug pull potentially.
Absolutely. I think when they make that change, they're moving away from another tenet, and that is, it used to be that everyone looked at as reported earnings, GAAP earnings, as the true earnings of a company, because that's what's really available after it's all over with to pay dividends, et cetera, right? And to retain an earnings.
Sure.
And it was a couple of decades ago that operating earnings became really popular. Wall Street said, you know what? Why don't we add back the non-recurring stuff since it's non-recurring? Well, I spent a couple of decades in private equity. And when we would value companies, the one thing we wouldn't do is add back all the non-recurrings. Because for some reason, companies seem to have more different kinds of non-recurrings the next year and different kinds of non-recurrings the following year.
Sure.
And so we need to recognize that the businesses, by definition, have certain amount of that element. And if you add it back in belief that it is going to be suddenly going to be available perpetually to pay dividends or going to be available to retain in earnings, then it's mistaken. And I think what we just talked about here was they're going to bring companies in. They're going to have losses, but they don't believe that they're going to be perpetual losses. And so pretty soon operating earnings is going to get more and more visibility to compensate for some of these very large companies that have got very large losses. They'll make the case that as reported earnings with those big losses in there aren't relevant anymore because these are companies that are distorting the index.
That's just sort of,
I think that to me, it's emblematic that we might be toward the later stage psychologically of the kinds of things that we saw back in the 90s, the things that we saw in the 20s.
Yeah. It is a sign of frothiness when companies that have a decade, if not century old process, decide that for the reason of competitiveness in a hyper-competitive world, that they're going to waive they're going to take off some of the guardrails in a sense.
I think that's the key. And again, none of this pretends, and even our discussion, I want to be really careful that as we talk about some of the risks on the horizon, that they're not, they do not appear to be on the near horizon.
Yeah.
No, I get that. At the same time, history has shown us that, that they don't, that a lot of times they don't appear on the far horizon. They just suddenly show up on the near horizon.
Right. They just, right? They just pop up.
And it's often not because one thing happens, but because several things happen at the same time to cause that, you know, it's some factor, you know, you've mentioned some things on this discussion, and I've seen some of the articles as well about there's certain retailers that are reporting some challenging short-term trends that are beginning to appear. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that you mentioned early off that are driving this, whether it's some of the leftover spending from 4 or 5 years ago, Inflation Reduction Act, et cetera, the Big Beautiful Bill, you know, there's just a, I think there's a lot of spending that has a very short term, very stimulative effect. And we're probably seeing some of the effects from that right now. Mm.
Crazy. Good stuff. So in closing, and let's talk about, of course, we'll have the information on Crestmont and Ed on the show notes for episode number 973 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So make sure to get your butts over there and check it out, by the way. But we got this inflation situation. We talked about the practicality of valuations and looking at either the Crestmont model or the CAPE model, which both have their similarities and differences significantly, that showing both that and of your other research, whether it's any of the metrics you look at, we're seeing, you know, pretty highly elevated, which again doesn't mean necessarily that elevation has to, we don't have to have a crash for that elevation to come back to normal levels, but we have to see potentially, which that could do it, but it also could be just a longer period of time of just a slowdown, if you will, just slowing the process. So that's something you mentioned. But one thing you didn't talk about, we didn't talk about very much, was this record level of debt that is now in the markets. It's a pervasive situation that has been, I think the propagation of debt that we've had, whether it's private credit, whether it's corporate debt, whether it's government debt, but the acceptance of utilizing not just debt, by the way, but extreme debt. For years, Ed, we scoffed. I don't know if you were a scoffer like me, but we laughed and chuckled and looked at Greece and Italy and the pigs. Oh, look. Oh my God. They got 200 to, you know, one or 2-to-1 GDP to price to earnings or whatever particular measure we use, GDP to debt or whatever, you know, whatever, right. or even the GDP, GDP. I'm thinking there was like so many different things and we would laugh, but we got to stop and look at ourselves in the mirror, don't we?
Well, and I think there are two things there. First is the debt that we have out there. The question is, what did we get for it? And I think that the dilemma is that it isn't that we're looking at and seeing all kinds of productive assets as a result of it. We're looking at a lot of programs where that money went, that the money spent, and it's not necessarily paying dividends. I'm concerned about the debt, but I'm highly concerned about the trend in the increase in debt, the deficit.
Yeah.
The deficits that we're seeing that are appearing at national, state, and local levels, and how the trend is toward raising taxes, fees, and other things to pay for that, which is just going to take, it's a vicious cycle of pulling out that purchasing power, pulling out that that investment power to meet consumption needs. And I think that's the farmer eating the seed corn. That's not a good thing to do.
Yeah, we call that cannibalism. Another way to look at it. You know, you could probably eat your own arm for a little while and it would just be probably nutritious, but after a while, things get a little bit hairy, don't they?
They do. You know? They do. So I think that's, and unfortunately right now, it doesn't seem that that from all sides, there are small elements of fiscal responsibility that are trying to influence the process. But I think there's a much larger constituency that sees, that has a desire to continue the spending.
Yeah, good stuff. Ed Easterling, always a pleasure. Glad that you're going to be entering into, where are we now? We're getting into the rainy season yet? No, not yet, right?
Oh, no, it's for Oregon?
Yeah.
Oh, no, actually, we're heading into dry season. So we're on the west side of Oregon. Here we're now moving from a kind of we've had a somewhat drier than average spring, but our summer times, people don't realize up here, the summer gets very dry, almost no rain in July and August. Hmm. Our fields go brown.
Really?
Huh. Trees stay green, but the fields go brown. And then we get the rain back again in September, and then we get most of our rain over the winter. So
aside from me talking to somebody in another country, we are probably the furthest apart distance wise. South Florida to Western Oregon.
Yes, we are.
Would it be just as close for me talking to somebody in London? I don't know. It's probably close.
Probably would be close. Now, you know, one thing we do have in common is your weather is relatively temperate, although on the warm side.
Yeah.
But and our weather over here is also relatively temperate. We don't get a lot of days on the western side of Oregon. We don't get very many freezing days, and we don't get very many really hot days because we get the Pacific Ocean right near us, and so that brings cooler air in at night, and then during the winter it brings warmer air in because it's coming across the ocean.
You do any fishing over there?
There is some fishing out here. Really good fishing.
What kind of stuff is caught there? Is it yellowfin tunas, yellowtail?
A lot of tuna. Yep. You can go.
You got the Pacific sailfish,
steelhead trout.
Oh, yeah, steelhead. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was in not too far. Well, far, but not too far farther than it is for me. But for you, I was in Alaska about 8 months ago and just had a great time with the halibut and the salmon.
Oh, Alaska's great fishing. I've been there a couple of times. Oh, and do you camp out or did you stay in a lodge?
You know me, I'm staying in a lodge. I could camp out. But at this age, at this point, I'm like, oh, I don't want to stay at the camp out. I'll stay in a lodge. Which, by the way, was not like a lodge. It was in between camping and a lodge.
Okay.
So it was great. Good stuff. Ed, thanks for coming aboard the Disciplined Investor Podcast. We'll do it again soon.
Andrew, you got it. Thanks. All the best.
Thanks. And another week and another great podcast guest, great discussion about what's going on around the world, especially with UBI and the things that are make you go, what's going on with that? But nonetheless, we have a lot to talk about now and through the end of the year. We have a whole slew of fantastic guests that are lined up for this show. We have great conversations, great education, information, all the things you need to be successful in this crazy market, crazy world of investing. Stay tuned, stay here, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'll see you next week. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.